Acceding to a request from Kane, a messenger went to fetch Reba DeFore and Domi from Descartes' home. Erica opted to meet to discuss tactics with her soldiers, while Mavati led the group of outlanders through the streets of Aten. There were more people out and about than any of them had seen previously. Frightened children clung to the sheer dresses of their mothers, while the men talked in low, grim tones, eyeing them suspiciously as they passed by. Word had leaked out of the attempted coup, and almost everyone was armed, carrying one form of weapon or another. Everything from sickles used in harvests to swords with strangely curved blades, spears, pole arms, and even axes.
Mavati, it looks like your people are preparing for war.
She nodded in misery, but said nothing. Lakish, Brigid, Domi, DeFore, Kane, and Grant followed the girl down a narrow, twisting lane until they reached a long, sprawling building. Its facade was unadorned except for a small caduceus, the ancient intertwined snake symbol of medicine.
What is this place?
The Hospital of Aten.
The interior was almost as plain as the exterior, with bare, whitewashed walls and exceptionally clean floors. The air smelled strongly of antiseptic. There were several wooden stools situated on the floor, as well as three benches lined up against each of the walls. A single desk sat by another doorway at the opposite end of the room. A woman, dressed in a comfortable-looking, tan-sleeveless shift, sat at the desk, writing on a piece of parchment. Her long black hair was streaked with threads of gray, but it flowed evenly across her shoulders and back. Her slanted eyes were shaded by blue makeup, and her thin lips were pursed in thought. She looked up and smiled at Mavati.
Yes, my princess?
Our guests would like to look at our medical facilities.
Why, may I ask?
It is the wish of the queen, Dr. Ningal.
The woman stood and opened a door behind the desk. She beckoned to them, and the visitors joined her, walking down a long corridor. Unlike the lobby, both walls were decorated in hieroglyphic style, depicting men and women performing various medical procedures, many of them holding what was clearly high-tech, modern tools. Doorways were on both sides of the corridor, some closed off from the rest of the building by wood, others by simple curtains of beads. Peering through the beads, Kane could see that several of the rooms were occupied by people who had suffered injuries during the battle at the audience chamber. The woman led them down the corridor and stopped at the second-to-last wooden door on the left. She held the door open for them and waited. Mavati waved them toward the doorway.
There is the proof you seek.
They stepped in, and DeFore uttered a murmur of surprise as her eyes swept over the heavy trestle tables loaded with a complicated network of glass tubes, pipettes, beakers, and flasks. They recognized a fermentation tank, a blood purification system, microscopes, and centrifuges from having seen similar things in the Cerberus infirmary, but there was much no one but DeFore and perhaps Lakesh could identify. The medic moved through the labyrinth of medical technology, exclaiming over several items.
My God! Three different kinds of bioreactors, oligonucleotide probes, even omni-gene cell analysis systems. This is cutting-edge apparatus, things I have only read about.
There is more, much, much more.
Turning, Mavati fixed a level gaze on Kane's face.
Are you satisfied now?
Reba, what do you think? Can this stuff help Quavel?
Kane, with this kind of equipment and the proper chemicals like gluten hydrosilate, I could help anybody.
Mavati indicated the disc Lakesh held in his hand.
That contains a comprehensive inventory of all medicines we have available.
Now we know what we'll receive in turn for hunting down and killing strangers.
We are not sending you out to assassinate our own people, Kane. What if they leave us no choice but to kill them? We can only hope you'll do everything you can to find another option.
Kane turned away from Mavati. He was distinctly aware of Brigid's gaze.
This is blackmail by any other name. But it's the only choice we have, Baptiste.
Brigid placed her hand on his shoulder, and Kane felt himself gathering strength from the simple gesture.
I know, Kane. No matter what happens, you always do what's best. Not just for yourself, but for everyone.
Rather than return to the safe house, Mavati arranged for an escort of incarnates to take the outlanders back to the home she shared with Descartes, while she rejoined her mother. Descartes was waiting for them. His face was a tight, grim mask as Kerr had helped him don his magistrate armor. Erica and her two troopers were there as well, helping themselves to the food laid out on the table.
The queen has gone back to the Sphinx to consult the oracles. Once they get a line on the bastards behind this, they'll let us know.
Lakesh nodded distractedly, tapping the disc against his chin.
Dr. Defore, do you have your laptop handy?
But Lakesh, Nephron said the disc was encrypted.
An impish smile creased Lakesh's lips. He said nothing, but Defore nodded in sudden comprehension and turned toward the doorway.
I'll get it.
Grant sampled a sweetmeat from the table.
I wish we had some kind of idea of the opposition. How many of these muties we may be up against?
Hopefully, the oracles can answer that question.
Too bad they didn't have answers about when a coup would be pulled.
Descartes nodded in embarrassment.
I know, but whoever is the ringleader of the insurrectionist must be able to shield not only his own thoughts, but those of others.
That's a pretty formidable ability. Probably beats out all the other telepaths we've run into over the years.
Bridget ran a hand through her mane of hair.
There could be a much simpler explanation.
What do you mean?
Let's settle the logistics of this little undertaking while we have the time.
Kane regarded Erica and her troopers with a chilly smile.
Erica, Domi and one of your Imperial Joy Boys will go with me.
Keep your enemies closer?
Something like that. Lakesh, you and Reba will be sitting this one out.
I won't be.
Erica smiled disdainfully.
Has it occurred to any of you that this whole insurrection business might be the Queen's way of getting rid of some political rivals while leaving her hands clean?
That's absurd and an insult to your hostess.
Descartes, did your IQ drop a dozen points since you've been living here? Regardless of her motivations, you're as much a pawn of the Queen as we are. We all have our reasons for being here, and the Queen is taking full advantage of them.
Erica bristled.
If anyone is being taken advantage of, it's her. Sam won't leave me here. If I don't return, he'll send troops to find me. If Nephron angers the Imperator, she'll have a lot more to worry about than a few dissidents.
Her eyes narrowed as she speared Kane with a gimlet-hard stare.
So don't get any ideas about killing me and putting the blame on the insurrectionists.
Kane shook his head wearily. Erica's paranoia and fanatic devotion to Sam grated on his nerves, even though he expected nothing less. He refused to dignify her warning with a response, but Lakesh was not so restrained.
Just make sure you don't have similar notions, Erica.
Erica arched an eyebrow at him, a smug smile crossing her face.
I only do what Sam asks of me, ever and always. Mohandas, it's not too late for you and the others to join our cause. We're your only protection against the Barons when they inevitably come to smoke you and your crew out of your little mountaintop hideaway. Your future lies with us.
I have it on very good authority that it doesn't, and I know why.
And you're that sure of yourself?
Oh, yes, very much so indeed.
How?
Lakesh smiled lopsidedly as Defore came in carrying the laptop.
For the time being, that will be our secret.
Erica's superior smile faltered, and Kane repressed one of his own, amused by Lakesh's enigmatic references to a recent event when they had received a message from the future. The communication had laid out, in a very shocking manner, what would befall the Cerberus personnel if they allied themselves with Sam and became part of what he called the Great Plan. Although the Cerberus warriors knew the path to take and the steps to avoid so as to minimize such a future coming to pass, no one in the redoubt felt particularly comfortable about an Imperator controlling the Vils instead of a group of hybrid Barons. According to the intel provided by Quavel, very few Barons felt good about it either. The ancient Roman Empire was governed by a Senate, but ruled by an Emperor, sometimes known as an Imperator. This person served as the final arbiter in matters pertaining to government. The Vils acted independently, unified in name only. The arrival of Sam, the so-called Imperator, changed all of that. All of them, Barons and Cerberus exiles alike, had believed the Barons were under the sway of the Archon Directorate, a mysterious race that had influenced human affairs for thousands of years. Allegedly, the sinister thread linking all of humankind's darkest hours led back to a non-human presence that conspired to control humanity through political chaos, staged wars, famines, plagues, and natural disasters. The nuclear apocalypse of 2001 was all part of the Archon Directorate's strategy. With the destruction of social structures and severe depopulation, the Archons established the Nine Barons and distributed pre-dark technology among them to consolidate their power over Earth and its disenfranchised, spiritually beaten human inhabitants. But over the past couple of years, all of them had learned that the elaborate backstory was all a ruse, bits of truth mixed in with outrageous fiction. The Archon Directorate didn't exist, except as a vast cover story, created in the 20th century and grown larger with each succeeding generation. The only so-called Archon on Earth was Balaam, the last of an extinct race that had once shared the planet with humankind. All of the Barons believed that they acted as the plenipotentiaries of the Archons, or they had until the destruction of the Archuleta Mesa installation. After the destruction of the Mesa installation, the Barons held an emergency council that dealt with only one topic, the survival of their people. Baron Cobalt, whom Lakesh had once served as a high advisor, put forth a proposal that would not only save the hybrids, but elevate him to a new position of power. During the council, Baron Cobalt proposed to establish a new central ruling consortium. In effect, the Barons would become viceroys, plenipotentiaries in their own territories. They were accustomed to acting as the viceroys of the Archon Directorate, so the actual proposal didn't offend them. Although each of the fortress cities, with its individual allegedly immortal god-king, was supposed to be interdependent, the baronies still operated on insular principles. Cooperation among them was grudging, despite their shared goal of a unified world. They perceived humanity in general as either servants or as living storage vessels for transplanted organs and fresh genetic material. The Barons were far less in favor of Baron Cobalt's intent to be recognized as the Imperator. However, they really didn't have much of a choice. After the destruction of the medical facilities in the Mesa, the Barons were left without access to the ectogenesis techniques of fetal development outside the womb, so not only was the baronial oligarchy in danger of extinction, but so was the entire hybrid race. Baron Cobalt presented his fellow barons with a way to stave off extinction by occupying Area 51, with the spoken assumption of taking responsibility to sustain his race, but only if he was elevated to a position of the highest authority. Area 51 was the pre-dark unclassified code name for a training area on Nellis Air Force Base. It was also known as Groom Lake, but most pre-darkers preferred to call it Dreamland. Contained in the dry lake bed was a vast installation, extending deep into the desert floor. Only a few of the buildings were above ground. Area 51 was more than just a military installation. It served as an international base operated by a consortium from many countries. Baron Cobalt proposed that a consortium of barons, which in turn would be overseen by him, supervise its operation. Since Area 51's history was intertwined with rumors of alien involvement, Baron Cobalt had used its medical facilities as a substitute for those destroyed in New Mexico. No one could be sure if the aliens referred to by the pre-dark conspiracy theorists were the Archons, but more than likely they were, inasmuch as the equipment that still existed was already designed to be compatible with hybrid metabolisms. In any event, Baron Cobalt reactivated the installation, turning it into a processing and treatment center without having to rebuild it from scratch, and transferred from the Dulce facility the human and hybrid personnel who had survived the destruction there. Still and all, the medical treatments that addressed the congenital autoimmune system deficiencies of the hybrids were not enough to ensure the continued survival of the race. The necessary equipment and raw material to implement procreation had yet to be installed. Baron Cobalt had unilaterally decided that the conventional means of conception was the only option to keep the hybrid race alive. When Baron Cobalt dangled the medical treatments before his fellow barons like a carrot on a stick, rather than share them freely, war was the inevitable result, particularly after Sam, supported by none other than Balaam, hijacked not only Cobalt's plan, but also the title of Imperator. Carrot, still in the process of helping Descartes put on the body armor, suddenly stiffened, drawing in a sharp breath. Closing her eyes, she pressed the fingertips of her right hand against her forehead. Her lips stirred slightly, as if she were whispering to someone only she could see.
What's going on?
Shh! She must be in telepathic communication with Mavati. They have a rapport that way.
Kerhet lowered her hand and opened her eyes.
The Queen summons the hunting parties to the audience chamber. The prey has been located.
Long before they reached the audience chamber, they heard the murmur of voices echoing down the corridor like the sound of rushing water. A crowd gathered below the throne, plotting around the base of the pyramid like swarming bees. Incarnates drew their ranks together, the V-prongs of the metal rods pointing outward. Nephron and Mavati were back at their places, regarding the people milling around the cavern with a combination of haughty disdain and impatience. Cassie stood on the left side of the throne. As Kane, Grant, Bridget, Domi, Descartes, Erica, and her two troopers entered, the distinct elements became evident in the crowd. They seemed not to mingle. Foremost around the pyramid, doing most of the shouting, were the priests. Standing farther back and appearing subdued in comparison were the nobles. Over the babble of many voices, they heard snatches of argument. Some said Aten ought to shut herself away in its hidden valley and tunnels. Others wrangled about baronial forces, whether they would learn of the city if the strangers were allowed to leave, whether or not Aten should strike first, whether or not both those issues were pointless because the queen would make the final decision. Men and women screamed at each other. The crowd parted as the group approached. Kane kept his eyes fixed on the throne, neither looking right nor left. He was glad that before leaving Descartes' home, he had taken two of the weapons Lakesh had brought from the Cerberus armory, the carbine and the 45 caliber automatic. When the outlanders had assembled around the throne, Queen Nephron held up her hands to silence the crowd, her blood-red gaze traveling over their faces one by one.
There are those in the kingdom of Aten who think that because I keep our glorious city hidden from the rest of the world, that I am weak and unfit to rule.
A muttering of resentful agreement arose from a number of the gathered people. Nephron paused for a few seconds and then continued.
Then there are those of you who feel we should be even more isolated than we are at present, and put all strangers to death who stumble across traces of our existence.
The answering murmurs were fewer in number, but no less vehement.
Aten has shaped us. We have a set of laws we live by. If we were in another place, we would not be the same people, and we would have a different set of laws. The dissenters who would like to see us rise up and challenge the might of the barons directly, to take our place as the rulers of the outlands, have forgotten that. Those who believe we should retreat even further have forgotten our laws as well. This is not a matter of right or wrong. It is a matter of abiding by our laws. If we do not, we are no longer Aten.
From the crowd, a voice called out.
But you're negotiating with two Outlander factions! How do we know that by doing so, you are not turning Aten into something else? An outpost of this so-called Imperator!
The queen's face remained impassive, although the crimson hue of her eyes seemed to deepen.
The Outlands and the Imperator mean little to me one way or the other. But I tell you this, I am not turning over control of our kingdom city. We will never bow before the Imperator or his representative. They, like our other guests, are here because we have something they want. If we can work out a mutual agreement, then for the first time since the death of my father, Aten will willingly open its doors to the outside, but only to those we choose.
Kane and Grant exchanged confused glances. The insurrectionists and the Akaku clearly wanted to wrest control from Nephron so that they could directly challenge the baronies and another group who wanted to keep the city separate from the rest of the world. Now Queen Nephron was talking about doing that very thing in a limited fashion. She walked a fine line.
But before such an action can be undertaken, much less discussed in an open forum, the kingdom must be made secure. And to that end, the insurrectionists and their allies, who brought violence into my audience hall, will be apprehended and neutralized. With the exception of our guests and others who will be directly involved in my counterinsurgency operation, everyone else must leave my chambers. Spread the word among my subjects, among the citizens of Aten. The first blow against my rule has been struck, but I will strike the second and final one. If those of you here like not my rule, then come and take my crown. You will have to fight and die for it.
More than a few angry comments reached Kane's ears as the assembled crowd milled out of the cavern. It was clear that many of the people weren't happy with what the queen had planned, and a substantial number might hold sympathetic views toward the insurrectionists. He glanced up as Queen Nephron watched the crowd file out of the huge chamber. She appeared to be remote and grimly determined. As if sensing his eyes upon her, the queen looked directly at him and nodded ever so slightly. K Kane returned the nod. Grant shifted his feet slightly, and Domi just looked on, paying full attention to what was happening around them. It took a great deal of willpower for Kane not to actually growl as Erica moved over to stand next to him. Her troopers made as if to follow, but a simple wave of Erica's hand caused them to stay where they were.
That did not go as well as I hoped, but better than it could have. What have your oracles learned? The insurrectionists have separated into several groups, and they're trying to consolidate their forces for an impending counterattack. Because their plan to control the Imperator's soldiers didn't go as smoothly as they had hoped, they feel that they must act now, while they perceive that I am still reeling from the initial onslaught.
As Nephron spoke, Kane noticed several people approaching from the far side of the cavern. He stiffened, ready to defend not only himself, but his companions as well. Then he realized that Queen Nephron was also watching them, apparently totally unconcerned. They were men in warrior harness, brandishing swords, bows, and quivers of arrows. To Kane's surprise, he saw that the man in the lead was the High Priest Opet. Without his robes, he looked like a soldier by trade. Wide in the shoulder, rangy and muscular. Old scars crisscrossed his torso. He gave Kane a strangely penetrating look as he and his companions took up position at the base of the pyramid.
Kane, you and Erica will lead a small squad consisting of several of my own warriors. Opet, you will act as guide.
As you wish, my queen.
Your Highness, I'm not trying to stir up a controversy, but isn't old High Priest Opet here opposed to Aten playing host to outsiders? Wasn't he suggesting all of us be put to death only a couple of hours ago?
Opet's lips creased in a haughty smile.
I spilled blood for Aten long before I was a priest, Outlander. I may disagree with the Queen's policy and let my dissatisfaction be known, but I am loyal to the kingdom she has ruled all my life, ever and always. From what I understand about you, that kind of loyalty is alien.
Kane felt anger and shame rushing warmth to the back of his neck, and his hand tightened on the stock of his carbine.
How many of the insurrectionists are we dealing with? How many of the Akaku?
Nephron leaned toward Cassandra, and several minutes passed as the queen conferred with the girl. Nephron shook her head in frustration.
The minds of the Akaku are very different, and neither I nor any of the oracles can receive more than flashes of their thoughts, flickers of intent. They are very angry, however, and will not surrender. If your father created them, surely you would have an idea of the different kinds. He created pairs of each, so they could mate. Two Horusians, two Bastions, two Kemuians, and two Thothians, one of whom you so skillfully dispatched.
Thank you. It was a rather remarkable shot.
I wasn't complimenting you. If you had not murdered him, he would have been a valuable source of information.
Killing in battle isn't murder, Your Highness.
In any event, the remaining members of the Akaku have been in the city for a long time, hiding in the catacombs. No doubt, the Bastion and the Horusian, who arrived at the redoubt yesterday, planned on joining their comrades here, where the final phase of the insurrection would be put into play.
What about the humans who are allied with them?
We've put several of them in custody. Unfortunately, the handful who have offered the Akaku help cannot identify a ringleader as such. Are they hiding their thoughts from you, from your oracles? They can try, but it will avail them nothing. Not when the diviners, Cassie in particular, sift through their minds. No, their memories of whoever has given them their orders were altered or completely erased by the ringleader himself. Whoever it was, their psionic powers are exceptionally advanced.
How do we know the ringleader won't just telepathically command us to forget about hunting down the Akaku, or force us to kill each other?
Damn good question. What kind of weapons they got? Who'd they get them from?
That we have never been able to determine, despite our best efforts.
I don't get it. You live in a ville full of Psi-muties, but don't know what other Psi-muties are up to?
Now that's an equally damn good question.
As a mag, he hadn't been faced with deep thinking on a regular basis. Baron Cobalt had laid down the laws, and mags made sure they were enforced. But now, questions piled on top of each other inside Kane's head. Still, he didn't put all of his questions into words. Nephron massaged her temples.
The nature of telepathic ability is very specific and very highly trained here. Those born with the ability have long since learned to always keep their mental shielding in place, to avoid a constant barrage of thoughts from those around them. So if one Psi wishes to contact another, they have to deliberately make the effort to mentally reach out in order to transmit or receive input from another mind.
Mavati picked up the thread.
That scan can vary from a superficial surface level to a precise plucking of one small bit of information from a whirlwind of mental impulses to a highly detailed examination of the individual's innermost thoughts, history, and basic nature, right down to feelings and memories that they themselves may no longer be consciously aware of. While a superficial scan is something the most untrained of our citizens can perform with only the barest amount of effort, a more detailed scan requires deep concentration.
As you already are aware, such a powerful and unique ability could easily give us access to the private thoughts and personal secrets of others. But our own honor code, ingrained from birth, prevents us from violating another being's privacy unless absolutely necessary.
Wouldn't you say this situation qualifies as necessary?
The people here have never used their telepathic abilities to harm one another. It's a testament to the trust the citizens share among themselves that most of them feel entirely comfortable here, without fear that their neighbor will be looking into their minds. To anybody who has been here a while, the notion that the citizens would violate each other like that is too absurd to take seriously.
Mavati smiled fondly down at her husband, but the Outlanders weren't so easily mollified.
The exact physical basis of the telepathic ability is unclear, though it's theorized that it involves the reading of electronic impulses that course through a living mind during thought, and that leave behind afterimages as memories and personality indicators.
That was my father's theory as well. He considered the ability not so much a power as a type of added sensory receptivity, for which the precise scientific explanation has not yet been uncovered. What is known is that the ability appears to be inheritable. In Cassie's case, neither of her parents was a telepath, but apparently some of her ancestors were said to have had some trace of the ability. Likewise, most of Aten's children manifest a very rudimentary telepathic ability, having fairly clear mental links with one another, and occasionally being able to catch a thought or emotion from someone else. As it is, I feel the telepathic ability is a primitive one, a throwback.
If telepathic ability took root in our ancestors, it would have been so valuable that it's surprising not to find it fully developed in modern humans.
A counterargument might be that telepathy is present to a greater extent in animals, and that, as in the case of the olfactory sense, humans lost their telepathic abilities. The reason could be that, following the emergence of a sophisticated spoken language, people had less need to rely on a purely mental and much less precise method of conveying thoughts.
All right, when do we move out?
Opet took it upon himself to answer.
I suggest as soon as possible. We must attack while our enemies are still weak and trying to consolidate their forces.
The main group has retreated to the catacombs where our departed are laid to rest. They feel that our own people will be reluctant to pursue them into the necropolis.
We need a map of the catacombs. Then we can move in from several sides, and all at once, to close off any possible means of escape.
I'll talk to our scribes and get some maps. They'll be accurate, unless...
Unless the insurrectionists have made their own changes in the catacombs, right? Digging new tunnels?
Right.
Kane thought that over for a few seconds, then shrugged.
Get the maps, Deckard. We'll have to take our chances and hope for the best.
Follow me.
Before he did the young man's bidding, Kane looked over at Erica Van Sloan.
Are your people ready to follow my orders?
They'll listen to me.
That's a little vague.
It'll have to do, but I intend to cooperate.
Kane stepped to one side and waved his arm toward Deckard.
After you, Imperial Mama.
The woman's eyes glinted hard for just a second. Then she sauntered past him, putting a little extra sway to her hips as she moved. Her pair of soldiers stayed behind her, keeping close. Kane didn't really fault them, since the view was very pleasant.
Kane.
Yeah?
We all need to talk before you head out.
Count on it.
With that, the Outlanders followed Deckard and all of the others involved in the hunt out of the audience chamber. Deckard and Opet led Kane, Grant, Bridget, Domi, and Erica into an adjacent chamber. Like the audience hall, the chamber was a cavern, but of much smaller dimensions. The walls were covered by colorful murals. In the center of the room rested a large wooden table, the legs of which were beautifully crafted to resemble those of a horse. As the Outlanders reached the table, they noticed that its surface bore carvings that depicted various Egyptian religious symbols, such as the Eye of Ra. A dozen elegant chairs circled the table. Kane ran his hand over the symbols and was surprised that the table felt perfectly smooth under his touch, yet each image was deeply ingrained in the wood. He realized that the entire wooden surface was covered in some sort of transparent varnish. Descartes removed a sheaf of parchment from a shelf and took a seat at one end of the table. Opet sat down directly across from him. The others followed suit, and Grant almost growled when Erica Van Sloan sat next to him. She met his scowl with a smug smile. Grant glared at her, but kept his mouth shut. Descartes spread out the maps of the catacombs. Kane leaned forward, studying them carefully. The parchment was covered by countless lines, arrows, and color-coded squares. The map was marked with many of the same glyphs he had seen covering the walls of the city.
Your mapmakers don't do things half-assed, do they?
Leaning back in his seat, Opet put his feet on the table.
Why would they? We have all the time in the world. Our artisans take great pride in the work they do.
Kane ignored the priest and let his eyes wander over the layout. With a forefinger, Bridget traced a single long tunnel that led to an octagonal chamber and then continued on to two more similarly shaped rooms. The tunnel leading past the third room showed numerous side tunnels leading to smaller chambers and even more tunnels. It was a virtual maze.
So this tunnel leads to what, a preparation chamber?
Yeah. There are a series of chambers. Each one is dedicated to one of the steps of mummification.
Grant pointed at the numerous tunnels that branched off after the third chamber.
What about these?
They're the crypts, where the bodies are kept.
I'll bet you that's where we'll find your rebels.
Kane questioned Descartes and Opet about several features he had noted on the map, all the while studiously ignoring Erica, even though he knew she was paying close attention as they discussed the route they would take to the catacombs. Domi remained silent for the most part, only occasionally asking for clarification. Domi then tapped a point on the map where an intersection appeared, a little past the preparation chambers. Catacombs and tunnels branched off from it, but they did finally converge in a single large chamber at the very edge of the map.
So this is where we're going to split up, then?
Seems reasonable.
Somehow, I don't think we'll be lucky enough to catch them there.
No way they would be stupid enough to hole up in that spot. So we're going to have to leave people at the entrance to prevent them from getting past us and out.
Leaning back in the chair, he looked toward Opet.
Seems pretty straightforward. Are you sure your people can be trusted?
They can be trusted to do their job. Can you and yours?
Kane felt himself bristle at the arrogance, but he didn't allow himself to react with anger.
I think so. I guess we'll both find out, won't we?
Opet's smile widened.
We have the honor of biting the head off the asp. Without it, the body will wither.
For a second, Kane almost asked how he knew that, but he kept the question unspoken. He knew the answer. He sighed, feeling both tired and somewhat impatient. As if sensing his discomfiture, Opet grinned.
We'll go as soon as you give the word.
Descartes, you ready?
I just want to get this over with, so we can get back to enjoying life.
Standing, Kane placed his hands on his hips and stretched his back, feeling the muscles move under his flesh.
All right. Let's do it. But I want to confer with my people first.
Suspicion flashed in Erica's eyes, but she said nothing. She and her troopers crossed the cavern to stand by the entrance. Opet regarded Kane, Grant, Domi, and Bridget with an expressionless face, then joined the others. He gestured to them, and they followed him out.
I don't like Opet, or trust him.
You think any of us does? He's got the attitude of a baron.
Yeah, and maybe their tendency toward treachery.
What are you getting at? You think he may have something to do with the insurrectionists?
Absolutely. Kane, you're going to be working with Opet and Van Sloan, so watch your ass.
Always.
The Outlanders left the chamber, and Opet led the way back through the main audience chamber. Kane eyed the priest's back as he followed him, wondering if he had overheard the conversation. Then he realized that considering the sheer number of telepaths that resided in the city, his thoughts were already being conveyed to Nephron. They followed Opet out of the Sphinx and into the streets of Aten. Opet led the party out of the main part of the city, toward the extreme end of the canyon. The farther down they went, the more the homes gave way to shops and storehouses, and finally even they tapered off, leaving just barren stone. It opened into a field of upthrust rocks, all of them of similar size and shape, approximately 6 feet tall and quarried flat on facing sides. They were arranged in a double row, with an aisle about 8 feet wide between them. The aisle ended at the mouth of a dark tunnel punched into the canyon wall. Kane turned and looked at Descartes, the angle of his eyebrows requesting an explanation. Before the young man could speak, Opet interjected.
The stones mark the boundary of the city. From here on, the main tunnel leads to the mummification chamber in the catacombs, our necropolis. So show the proper respect.
Arrogance was a quality that Kane had never much cared for, and he found himself disliking Opet all that much more. Looking over at Grant, he could read the same thoughts on the big man's face. Bridget, as usual, wore her poker face, but her eyes snapped green sparks of repressed anger.
Descartes, have you ever been there before?
Yeah, a couple of times. I guess I wanted to see everything. And after what Mavati told me about the way they dispose of their dead, I had to check it out myself.
Kane addressed the assembled group, hefting the carbine.
We're about to enter dark territory, people, so get your weapons ready. Stay on triple red.
Without so much as glancing at Opet, Kane turned to the rest of the group.
Descartes, you're with me. Opet, you follow, but stay at least a good 30 yards behind. Grant, stay with him. Domi and Baptiste, you fall back about 10 yards. Erica, I want you and your drones to follow about 3 yards behind them.
We're bringing up the rear?
We can't afford anyone sneaking up on us. Look at it as a show of my trust in you. Just keep the noise to a minimum.
Erica's eyebrows knitted at the bridge of her nose.
Do you think we're a bunch of amateurs?
As a matter of fact, I do.
Turning his back to her, and missing the obscene gesture she had made, Kane faced the tunnel mouth. He took a deep breath and entered the necropolis of Aten. Upon his arrival in Aten, one thing that Kane had noticed was the overall cleanliness of the city. That devotion to neatness extended even underground. There was a distinct lack of dust and debris along the floor of the tunnel as he walked along its course, keeping close to the left-hand wall. The rock floor pitched slightly downward and was worn smooth, either by tools or the passage of many feet over many years. The passageway was dark, but not black, the gloom alleviated by flickering bronze lamps set in wall sconces every dozen or so yards. He quickly realized the map's depiction of the tunnel was slightly misleading. It didn't run straight, but meandered to the right. Moving quickly and with the stealth learned from years of being a point man, he quickly reached the first intersection and came to a halt. Kane saw a glimmer of faint light to the right, and turning in that direction, he saw a broad arch. Side by side, he and Descartes moved to the entrance of the mummification chamber. Kane waved a hand, indicating that those behind them should stop. Peering through the gloom, Kane saw distorted shadows dancing along the floor and walls of the tunnel. For an apprehensive half-second, Kane thought that the chamber was occupied, and then he realized that the light was shed from torches. He half expected to see a dozen armed insurrectionists, but the tunnel remained empty. Creeping forward, walking heel to toe as always in a potential kill zone, Kane kept his gaze on the chamber beyond the stone arch. He started to make out details of the chamber itself. Directly in front of him, in the dead center of the chamber, stood a black stone slab, massive and somber. Even by the dim illumination, Kane saw the body-shaped indentation in the top of the slab. Several large urns and jugs lay around the base of the slab, as well as a wooden table holding tall stacks of bleached linen. Stealthily, he crept into the room. Kane saw only one exit from the chamber. He motioned with his hand for the rest of the people to join him. They spread out across the chamber, looking around alertly.
This is the Ibu. It's the place of purification.
I see. Go on.
Opet interjected again.
Here the dead are brought, the bodies washed carefully. Originally, the embalmers used palm wine and then rinsed it with water from the Nile. But since this isn't Egypt, we use wine that is grown locally and water from the underground river.
It's really quite fascinating.
Bridget came up to the stone slab and ran her hand over the indentation.
I remember reading that after they cleansed the body, they then removed all of the internal organs except the heart.
That's right. Since the entrails are the first part of the body to rot, they have to be removed quickly to avoid bloating.
So why did they leave the heart, then?
Opet smiled almost cruelly.
The ancient ones believed that the heart was the originating source of intelligence and emotions, not the brain. So they used a long hooked needle, and inserted it through the sinus passage in order to pull the brains out.
Blech!
Kane let his eyes wander over the walls. He noticed that the hieroglyphs depicted exactly what the priest talked about. Not only was the room used for preparation, but also the exact instructions on what to do were displayed so that anyone could follow them with relative ease.
The stomach, liver, intestines were carefully washed as well, and then packed in natron, a natural salt used to dry out the organs.
Wow, that sounds a lot easier than just burying the body. Let's move it.
Taking the point again, Kane moved across the chamber and out into the adjoining passageway. The distance to the next chamber was less than 30 yards, but he approached it cautiously. This room was approximately the same size as the last one, but instead of a single stone slab in the center of the room, the walls were perforated with alcoves, three to a side. Like the first chamber, it was roughly octagonal in shape. Less than a third of the alcoves contained anything. The rest contained tall, vaguely humanoid shapes shrouded in gauze. The fabric appeared to be covered in a white, granulated powder. Kane saw four clay jars inside the alcoves. As he had done before entering the purification chamber, Kane carefully scanned it, looking for any sign of occupation. When he was satisfied that the chamber held only shadows and the shrouded bodies, he stepped in, beckoning for the others to join him.
This is the chamber where the bodies are dried out.
Opet reached out to touch the linen swathings. A little cloud of powder puffed up under his touch.
The wrappings are saturated with natron, and the body cavities are stuffed with it as well. We leave them here for 40 days, until all moisture is dried from their bodies.
What's with all the jars?
Those are canopic jars, containing the organs that were removed. Each one represents one of our gods. For instance, that one over there is Imseti. It holds the liver.
Noticing that both Erikaven Sloane and Domi grimaced, Opet pointed to the other jars, seeming to take a boyish relish in their reactions.
That's Hoppy, and this jar contains the lungs. And the next one, the jackal-headed one, is Duamutef. It holds the stomach.
And that one?
That's Kabisenuif, where the intestines are stored.
Kane spotted a smaller jar, one that seemed to be fabricated of metal instead of clay like the others. The whole container bore the outline of a pregnant woman.
Why is that one so different?
Opet actually looked uncomfortable as he replied.
That's Isis, the goddess of fertility. That hermetically sealed jar contains a sample of the dead person's genetic code.
Genetic material? Is Nephron planning on cloning these people?
We keep it for posterity's sake. Perhaps one day it will be very useful to a member of the deceased one's family.
That makes a certain amount of sense. The donor cells are forced into hibernation, and the hibernation brings about a genetic reprogramming of the cell, switching the adult cells back to an embryonic state.
What good would that do?
Conceivably, scientists here in Aten could take a normal unfertilized egg from a woman and remove the DNA from it. Taking the DNA-empty egg, they would immerse it in a solution with the reprogrammed donor cell. An electric current is passed through the donor and the egg cell, fusing them together. The new cell is then planted into a surrogate mother. The baby that results is genetically identical to the donor.
Bridget glanced over at Descartes.
I wouldn't be too surprised to learn that was the method of Mavati's birth.
Although Descartes didn't answer, Kane found the information fascinating. He smiled to himself, realizing just how much of Baptiste's influence had rubbed off on him over the past couple of years. He turned toward the exit and left the chamber. The tunnel stretched for 30 yards and opened up into a third chamber. As with the first one entered, there was a single large stone slab rising from the floor. Several jars stood atop it. Tall shelves were bracketed to the stone wall, each one filled to capacity with rolls of fresh linen.
I guess this is where the mummified remains are wrapped.
Yes. First, oil is rubbed into the skin to keep it from breaking. The corpses are filled with sawdust, leaves, and linen so as to maintain a lifelike appearance, at least for the first few decades.
Kane looked at the murals on the walls and saw the steps that Opet had described. He even noticed how the corpses were wrapped, the first image showing the head and neck being wrapped first, then each finger and toe. The arms and legs were wrapped separately, and finally the torso. The illustrations showed strangely shaped amulets placed inside the wrappings. The next image showed the arms and legs being tied together with a scroll held between the hands. The final image showed the wrapped body taken by mourners into a crypt for its final rest. Impulsively, Kane stepped up to the slab and lifted the lid from one of the jars. A strong, sweet odor wafted out from the opening, and he saw it was filled with thick oil. Replacing the lid, he crossed the chamber and looked through the door and down the adjoining tunnel. As had all the other stretches, it appeared deserted. He glanced over his shoulder at the people in the chamber.
So far, so good.
That could change.
In fact, I know it will, sooner before later.
Grant glowered at him.
Why, Opet, you'd almost think you were psychic or something.
Turning, Kane fixed his gaze on Opet's face.
You'd think they would have tried to ambush us by now, or that we would have found some trace that they were here in the first place.
What do you expect, Kane? The insurgents aren't stupid, and staging an attack against as well-armed a force as we are, even with a psionic leg up on our plans, wouldn't have much chance of succeeding. No, they'll be waiting for us in the crypts. There can be no doubt about that.
Kane considered Opet's words.
Considering how extensive the maps showed the catacombs are, I'm tempted to break our group into smaller bodies so that we can cover more ground. But that would mean reducing our fighting capability.
Descartes and Opet nodded in agreement.
You want us to stay in position?
Kane became aware of the mocking stare Erica had fixed on him.
Yeah, at least for now.
Kane took the point again. He paused only long enough to make sure the others took up their assigned positions. As he eased into the passageway, he immediately noticed that the stretch ahead wasn't as well lit. There weren't as many brass lamps as he had seen before, and there was a visible increase in the amount of dust and debris on the floor. He stopped and knelt on one knee. A number of people had passed through the tunnel, judging by the scuff marks and blurred footprints in the dust, but he had no way of knowing how long ago it had been.
Domi, what do you make of these tracks?
About 10 people came this way.
How long ago?
She took a pinch of dust between thumb and forefinger and let it sift down.
Not long. An hour at the most, maybe less.
With a word of thanks, Kane continued down the passageway. Domi returned to her position. About 60 yards down the corridor, they came to an X intersection. He wasn't sure which way to go, but as he had done many times in the past, he decided to trust his instinct to guide him. He turned back to Descartes.
Everybody wait here. Stand guard at all the tunnels.
What are you going to do?
I'll scout ahead a little way. I'll only be gone a minute.
Kane moved slowly down the left-hand tunnel. Although he didn't possess Brigid's gift of an eidetic memory, he recalled from the maps that the entrance to the crypt complex lay ahead. Just as he came within sight of the square-cut doorway, he heard soft footfalls behind him. Glancing over his shoulder, he saw Descartes moving up swiftly.
Grant sent me ahead. He figured you might need your six watched.
Kane tamped down the surge of irritation and only nodded. Together, they continued into the first of the chambers. It held an oddly shaped 8-branched candelabra in which black candles burned with guttering flames. The illumination barely penetrated the near total darkness, as if not to disturb the eternal slumber of those interred in the tomb. Unable to fully adjust to the gloom, Kane donned his night vision glasses. The built-in light intensification feature of the lenses allowed him to see clearly in deep shadow for approximately 10 feet, as long as there was some kind of light source. The red-tinted visor of Descartes' mag-issue helmet served several functions. It protected the eyes from foreign particles, and the electrochemical polymer was connected to a passive night sight that intensified ambient light to permit one-color night vision. The tiny image enhancer sensor mounted on the forehead of the helmet didn't emit detectable rays. The limits of its range were only 25 feet, even on a fairly clear night with strong moonlight. Kane saw 8 large oblong cavities dug into each of the walls. Each cavity held a tall, carved sarcophagus of red and black lacquered wood. On the lids of every case, graven in ivory, was the countenance of the occupant. Curiosity got the better of the former magistrate, and he approached the nearest one. A series of tiny pictographs and hieroglyphs was neatly inscribed in the stone at the base of each niche, depicting the life and important events of those interred. A shelf was built into the cavity above the mummy case, holding 4 canopic jars. The sarcophagus itself was a thing of beauty. The image on the lid presented what he assumed to be a very close approximation of the person within it, right down to the color of the eyes, as they had appeared in the prime of their life. Once again, Kane was deeply impressed by the awe-inspiring artistic talent possessed by the citizens of the city. Apparently, their talents at housekeeping were restricted to the streets above. Layers of dust covered everything, which indicated the age of the burial chamber. He realized this chamber was probably the first of the crypts to be constructed. Motioning for Descartes to take the opposite side of the chamber, Kane made his way along the wall until he reached the hallway connecting the next series of crypts. The lighting didn't improve. As they approached the next burial chamber, a nauseating stench clogged his nostrils.
Oh, goddamn! Somebody's embalming technique needs work.
Kane placed a finger to his lips, annoyed that the younger magistrate had broken the silence. But he couldn't deny the odor was of old death, dusty, musty, and putrid all at once. Suddenly, from within the burial chamber, he caught a brief flicker of movement, and he raised the carbine. Descartes spied the shifting of shadows, too, and snapped up his sin-eater. Even with the light amplification that his glasses provided, Kane could just barely make out the figure at the end of the tunnel. He assumed one of the insurrectionists had shown himself, but the form moved toward them slowly, listing from side to side, almost as if it were shambling. He heard a rustling, scraping sound accompanying the figure's approach, then a faint noise as of wood creaking. Whirling, Kane brought up his auto rifle. He saw the lid of a sarcophagus slowly rising, pushed up from within. The stench of putrefaction increased almost exponentially, and even as he watched, gnarled brown fingers curled around the edge of the lid. Flesh crawling with revulsion and a mounting horror, Kane felt rooted in the mire of a nightmare. The ripping sound of Descartes' sin-eater on full auto broke the spell of terror threatening to engulf Kane's mind. By the strobing flame licking from the pistol's bore, Kane saw a withered, wizened shape with dried, dark limbs like dead wood. The figure shambling from the burial chamber was a mummy, and Kane's reason recoiled from the sight, his breath seizing in his lungs. The fusillade tore strips from the animated cadaver's body, the impacts turning it this way and that, but it still shuffled forward.
This is not fucking happening! This is not fucking happening!
The mummy staggered under the 9mm hammer blows, and it fell backward, arms and legs twitching. Kane returned his attention to the creature pushing its way out of the mummy case. The bandages had come loose from around its head, revealing leathery flesh drawn drum tight over the contours of the skull. A bright red, malevolent light gleamed inside the empty sockets, sending a stream of mad fear through Kane. Its jaws opened and closed in a sickening, silent pantomime of speech. He squeezed the trigger of the carbine, holding it down, firing through the entire magazine, blasting out waves of ear-shattering sound. The skull of the creature flew apart under the barrage, and two of the canopic jars in the niche behind it shattered amid sprays of clay and desiccated viscera.
This is not fucking happening! This can't be fucking happening!
Looking down the passageway, Kane saw the mummy Descartes had fired upon, staggering back to its feet, hooking its fleshless, claw-like fingers into the wall and hoisting itself upright. Slowly, with jerky movements, as if responding to the tug of invisible puppet strings, the cadaver advanced upon Kane and Descartes. Kane could only stare, unable to blink or breathe or even think. At the fringes of his awareness, he heard the scraping creak of more mummy case lids opening. He watched as all of the sarcophagi opened, the wrapped corpses rising from their resting places. He felt as if the blood in his veins had congealed into icy mud. Kane dropped the carbine with a loud clatter and drew the Colt automatic. Holding it in a two-handed grasp, he squeezed off single shots, carefully placing the rounds through the skulls of the mummies, although he had no idea how he could possibly kill something that was already dead. Descartes continued to fire his sin-eater, blowing away half of the mummy's skull. No blood poured from the wound, and pieces of cranial bone clattered against the floor and walls. He put his back to Kane as the withered corpses shambled toward them in a hideous mockery of life and movement. Shifting his aim downward, Kane fired a round at a mummy's knee joint. Dried flesh and bone shattered, the knee literally disappearing in an explosive mushroom cloud of dust, rags, and fragments of ancient cartilage and leathery skin. The mummy fell forward as its leg collapsed, but it still continued to crawl toward him, using its arms and remaining leg to propel it along the tunnel floor. Kane fired directly into its face, the .45 caliber wrecking ball shearing away its jawbone. Teeth rattled off into the shadows like a handful of parched corn kernels. Following his lead, Descartes aimed for the knee and elbow joints on another of the walking corpses. He squeezed off four shots in rapid succession. The mummy was bowled off its feet as a shin bone splintered under the fire. It fell to the ground, flopping helplessly as it tried to rise again. Kane fired on another mummy, shattering its spine completely, its torso folded in half like a jackknife, its head dangling between its legs. Despite the cold sweat of terror beating his brow, he was able to think a bit more clearly. Returning rationality pushed away the fog of unreasoning horror. Although the gunfire was effective, the results were too slow. He knew he had to come up with a faster method of disposing of the cadavers without burning through all of their ammunition. Burning. Kane's gaze darted to the candelabra, and with the thought came motion. He lunged forward, back into the burial chamber, elbowing the cadaver aside. He heard ribs crunch under the impact. The claw-like hand of another mummy reached for his face, and his cheek was scratched by split black fingernails. The bandaged creature lurched directly into his path, arms outflung as if inviting an embrace. Kane ducked beneath it and grabbed the candelabra. Even through the gloves of his shadow suit, he felt the heat of the brass. A brown, gnarled hand darted for his throat, and he spun out of reach, touching the flame of a candle to a dangling scrap of bandage. The ancient, oil-treated linen instantly caught fire like dry tinder. Tongues of flame engulfed its body, leaping from limb to limb. In a matter of seconds, the animated corpse burned as brightly as a torch. Even though the mummy was burning up, it still took several shambling steps, its unnatural mimicry of life keeping it on the move. Kane kicked it against one of its brethren. The bandages of the other creature caught fire with an explosive pop. Both of the mummies collapsed, arms entwined in a mass of roaring flame. The heat seared Kane's face, and he backed away. As if striking out in defiance, one of the cadavers lashed out at Kane with an arm, its bony fingers closing around his right ankle. Kane stomped on the wrist with his left foot, putting all of his weight down. The forearm snapped like a broken stick, and he kicked the severed hand away. He touched a candle to another mummy's wrappings, and almost immediately the fire spread over the creature's body, consuming it in a blaze of blue and orange flame. Descartes hurled the final shambling corpse against it. Both figures were completely consumed, falling apart before their eyes, the glowing embers of blackened bones scattering over the floor. The two men fanned the smoky air away from their faces and coughed at the acrid stench. The pounding of running feet echoed loudly in the chamber as Grant rushed into the room, eyes and sin-eater questing for a target. He skidded to a clumsy halt as his gaze took in the scene of blazing carnage.
You gotta be fucking kidding me!
Do you see anybody laughing, Grant?
Grant stood there, staring through the smoke at the flickering coals, too stunned to speak. Opet, Bridget, Domi, and Erica Van Sloan and her troopers rushed into the chamber. Even Opet gaped dumbfounded at the pyres.
Let's get out of here.
All of them traversed the tunnel, anxious to get out of the range of the smoke and the stench of burned oil, flesh, and cloth. The next burial chamber was identical to the first, but it had two exits, one on the opposite wall and another to their right. One of the sarcophagi hung open. It was empty.
Guess that's where your friend came from, Descartes.
When Opet entered, he turned to face the priest.
Is this something that happens often?
I had no idea that they would desecrate our dead like that.
Your people can do that, Opet? Bring the dead back to life?
No, of course not. We can't raise the dead. There's no way. The only way that could have happened is if the insurrectionists have someone or several people with telekinetic ability.
Telekinetic-fucking what now?
Telekinesis, or psychokinesis. The ability to move things with the energy of the mind, moving objects from one place to another without using physical contact. It also means reshaping objects, using the mind's energies, such as bending a spoon or key by just holding it and focusing. Psychokinesis comes from the Greek word psyche, meaning life or soul, and kinesis, meaning to move.
Kane looked from left to right and then ran his hand across his face, wiping away a layer of sweat and ash.
It would be safe to assume that the insurrectionists do have people with that ability, then. Van Sloan, I want you and your blastermen to spread out along this tunnel.
He pointed down the passageway to the right.
You're right. If there's going to be a pincer maneuver, it'll come from there.
The violet-eyed woman nodded to Grant, then to her soldiers. They went through the doorway without hesitation or argument. Descartes' lips were ashen and sweat glistened on his cheeks. The barrel of his sin-eater trembled ever so slightly.
What about us? What are we going to do?
Descartes, I want you to... What the hell?
The room seemed to heave around them as the sound grew in volume, vibrating deep in their bones. Kane looked up at the ceiling of the chamber. A cascade of dust spilled from a widening network of cracks. Chunks of stone and earth pelted down from above. Everyone rushed for the doorway as the ceiling crumbled. Large slabs of rock fell and clouds of dust arose, blinding eyes and filling lungs. As Kane tried to run, a downrushing avalanche of stone and loosed earth engulfed him. Grant, Domi, Bridget, Descartes, and Opet stood on the other side of the settling rock pile, staring at it in near disbelief. As far as they could see through the pall of dust, the entire ceiling had collapsed.
God damn it. How the fuck are we supposed to get through this shit?
Opet stepped up to the doorway, his hands on his hips.
It's going to take a while for them to get here, but I can summon a crew and start clearing this out of the way.
Summon them how? Oh.
Kane could be hurt.
Bridget stepped up to the stone-clogged doorway. Behind her, Erica Van Sloan and the two soldiers stood silently, watching and waiting. Feeling both helpless and enraged, Grant whirled, looking for someone to take his anger out on. One of Erica's troopers stood within arm's reach. Grant grabbed the startled man and threw him bodily at the mound of dirt and stone.
Start digging, asshole.
The other soldier standing with Erica raised his weapon threateningly, but the raven-tressed woman motioned for him to put down the subgun. Grant glared at her, expecting to see anger contorting her face, but to his surprise, he saw instead sympathy in her violet eyes. He took a deep breath, forcing the rage and frustration down, letting his intellect overrule his passion. Erica gestured for the trooper to step up to the doorway.
Help him.
The soldier's lips twisted as if he wanted to spit, but he shouldered his weapon and pushed past Grant. He and his companion pulled at the stones and debris, clearing away as much as they could. Grant found that he couldn't bring himself to actually thank the woman, so he nodded to her in acknowledgement. She smiled slightly.
You might not believe this, but I would not take any pleasure in Kane's death. Or yours, for that matter.
A crew with the appropriate tools should be here in about 10 minutes.
Deckard shouldered between the pair of Imperial troopers.
That might be 9 minutes too long.
He began digging with his gauntleted hands, small stones clattering to the tunnel floor. Grant pointedly looked at Opet, and then at the rock pile.
What are you waiting for?
You actually expect me to help?
Grant moved over to the men who were already hard at work, trying their best to clear away the detritus from the chamber door. Deckard and the troopers wrestled with a large chunk of rock, trying to pull it through the archway. Kneeling before the rock, Grant took several deep breaths, then wrapped his arms around the stone and pulled with all his might. The tendons on his neck and head stood out in stark relief as he strained to move the massive piece of rock. Slowly but surely, with dirt sliding from around it, he began to pull it free. Deckard wormed his way next to the huge man in order to help.
You're just going to get in the way.
And you're just going to rupture something.
Opet had joined him and stood on the opposite side of the doorway, facing the young man. The priest knelt before the stone and placed his hands beneath it, motioning with his head that Deckard should do the same. Working in unison, straining until their muscles bulged and sweat poured down their faces, the three of them worked the stone free amid a small avalanche of dust, dirt, and loose gravel.
One down.
Yeah. Only a couple hundred more to go.